This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Malaysia's Ministry of Environment has approved two genetically modified corn varieties for food, feed and processing use this year. This brings the total of GM products allowed for use in Malaysia under the 2007 National Biosafety Act to 14. But a heated debate over their safety is still ongoing. Civil society groups claim they pose serious health and environmental risks, while the pro-GM lobby says there's no scientific evidence for this. Joining me in the studio to discuss this further is Lim Lee Lin, a senior researcher with Third World Network. Lee Lin, what is genetic engineering, to start us off?
Good afternoon. Thanks for inviting me here. Well, genetic engineering is a scientific laboratory technique to basically transfer genes of interest into other organisms. So basically from one organism to another in a way that wouldn't occur naturally in nature. So for example, traits that are considered beneficial, like insect resistance or herbicide tolerance, have been transferred into crop plants. And this is supposed to be able to help farmers who are dealing with pests as well as to reduce herbicide use.
What's the difference between, because I mean, what you're describing also sounds like what we're taught in school, you know, people who've cross-pollinated in order to try and get as strong a set of crops as possible. What's the difference between doing that and genetically modifying the food?
Well, basically, with genetic modification, this happens in a lab with certain techniques. And so you can actually genetically modify things that are not closely related in nature. Whereas with breeding, they have to be closely related. And this process takes a long time, where you would selectively choose the traits you want and then breed them in to closely related species. So basically what we're doing with genetic modification is moving traits and genes across different organisms that would normally never interbreed in nature. For example, a good example of this was an experiment putting spider genes into goats so that they can produce spider silk in their milk.
This is what happens in the labs, but once we take it down to the ground in the farms, what's the difference between conventional crops and genetically modified ones? Can we see any difference? You know, would we taste any difference?
Well, it's unlikely that you could actually see any difference, I guess, unless you're an experienced farmer or agriculture researcher. But I guess to the naked eye, you really can't see anything, and you'd probably not taste any difference either. It's really down at the genetic, at the molecular level.
Why is there a need for GM foods? What's resulted in their proliferation around the world?
Well, it depends on who you ask. So the GM industry will, of course, tell you that there is a great need for GM food because, we have more than 6 billion people in the world. The world can't produce enough crops to feed the world. And so GM is a technology that will help to feed the world. And of course, there are other reasons for this as well, which is to help the farmers, in their fight against pests and also to attempt to try to reduce the use of harmful chemicals in agriculture.
Having said that, you know, it sounds like a godsend. It sounds like a dream. You have, the perfect crops. You're helping everybody involved. Poorer countries get to have more resilient crops. But there are a lot of concerns over GM foods, and they have been quite vociferously voiced. What are the main concerns?
Yes, this has been one of the most controversial technologies, and this debate has been raging for decades, basically. There are many, many concerns that have been raised. And broadly speaking, they range from environmental to health, food safety issues, as well as to social and impacts on the economy. So, for example, many issues have been raised with regards to toxicity and increased allergenicity. But also increasingly, many independent scientific studies are starting to point towards more serious long-term effects on human health. With regards to environmental issues, there's a whole array of issues again. For example, impacts on non-target organisms, because some GMOs are engineered to be resistant to certain types of pests. But of course, this has a much bigger impact on the ecology as a whole. So there are many, many issues there as well.
Let's talk a little bit more about health risks. Could you tell us more about the potential risks to human health? You mentioned allergies, toxicity. Perhaps you could elaborate?
Well, There have been many, many studies conducted. One of the more recent and and hotly debated studies actually was done by a team, Professor Giles Eric Seralini in France, a research group that actually did the only independent long-term study on GM food safety, and they were actually doing a toxicity study. And basically this study ran for 2 years, which is the lifespan of a lab rat, right? Most of the studies that have been conducted, especially the ones presented by industry and which are the ones that are presented to our regulators to approve GMOs, are only conducted for usually up to 90 days. And Dr. Seralini's study basically found that there were tumours in the rats after they had been fed and observed for a period of 2 years. So, of course, this raised a big controversy with debates on both sides.
That's the point that I actually wanted to explore a little more. I mean, when we talk about health and when we talk about risks, with the introduction of GM foods over the last few decades, has enough time elapsed for us to really see the long-term effects that it could have on human health, in your opinion?
Well, on human health, no, because the lab rats have a lifespan of 2 years, but of course human beings live a lot longer. So if we're actually going to do any human studies, they have to be for a lot longer. And one of the problems with not being able to see results is that, for example, in a country like the US, where GMOs have been introduced very early on, and it is claimed that there are no adverse effects because nobody's seen any, but that's because nobody's looked for any. There is no mandatory GM labeling in the US, so it would be impossible to monitor the population to try to do a study on what kind of effects there have been on people who have been consuming GMOs as opposed to people who have avoided consuming GMOs.
Scientists who are pro the use of GMOs have often said that, you know, it's nothing more than fear-mongering. It's, you know, as you say, you know, the studies are, they say, inconclusive. And they also say it's necessary to feed poorer countries, reduce pesticide use and so on. What would you have to say in response to people who say, you know, it's just fear-mongering and it's fine?
Well, I think one important aspect to look at is always the independence of the studies, because studies can be done by industry or funded by industry and which have industry links. And the general tendency of those studies is to find that there are no adverse effects. But many studies that are independent, that have no links to industry, that are actually done by independent research groups, have pointed to issues and problems that really need further study. Now, many of these studies are quite preliminary, but whenever they have published in scientific peer-reviewed journals calling for more research to be done and that they have found troubling effects, and often never really claiming very much, but just pointing towards the fact that more studies need to be done, this has been totally shut down by the GM industry. And so as a result, funding for more independent research just isn't available. And of course, the kind of pressure that these scientists come under is tremendous.
At the moment, what GM foods are approved for use in Malaysia?
There are, as you said, 14 GMOs that have been approved basically for food, for animal feed and for processing. 8 of these are corn and 6 of these are soya beans. The soya beans are actually soya beans that are tolerant to herbicides. And with the corn, it's both herbicide tolerance as well as insect resistance.
What about papayas and mosquitoes that have been approved for field trial? Do you have concerns about those?
Yes, certainly. I mean, we raised a lot of concerns about the release of GM mosquitoes. These were in trials, and the field trials were conducted in Bentong. And these mosquitoes were basically engineered to be to address the dengue problem, and they were engineered so that once they were released into the environment, when they mated, they would actually cause the progeny to be infertile, thus in the hope of eradicating the mosquito population, the Aedes population. This, however, means that the scientists had to breed thousands and thousands of mosquitoes and continually release these genetically modified mosquitoes into the environment. And the ecological impact is really unknown. But actually, these trials have now been stopped, and the government, there have been news reports that the government will not continue with them because the cost is simply prohibitive when there are other much better ways of dealing with dengue than a quick, high-tech, fix-it solution.
I'm speaking today with Lim Lee Lin, a senior researcher with Third World Network. We are discussing GM foods in Malaysia. Up next, we're discussing the regulation in our country of this labelling and so on. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. In the studio with me, Lim Lee Lin, senior researcher from Third World Network. We are discussing GM foods in Malaysia. How are they regulated at the moment in our country?
In Malaysia, we have a biosafety law which was passed in 2007. So basically, any GMO that is going to be imported into the country or released or placed on the market needs to go through an approvals process. We actually also have food regulations that deal with labeling of GMOs, but this has yet to be implemented.
So at the moment then, if we go to our, you know, average supermarket looking to purchase tofu or corn or some such, would we know whether something was manufactured or contains GMOs?
No, we wouldn't, because the labelling rules are not yet have not yet been implemented, so it's not really possible to know. Of course, sometimes you do see on the shelves they might claim to be non-GM-free or non-GMO, or usually if they are organic, they're not genetically modified. But, you know, all that needs proper scrutiny of what the labels really mean.
When we say things like organic, you know, that's a real buzzword that's captured a lot of people when it comes to eating, when it comes to purchasing their groceries. Do you think that GM-free has done much the same? Are people actually conscious of trying to be GMO-free when they're eating or when they're making those purchases?
I think that's certainly true, which is probably the reason why the GM industry fiercely resists any kind of labelling, because it would actually mean that consumers then know and would have the choice and would probably avoid, if they can, buying GMOs.
Going further back than that, to your mind, do our environmental laws sufficiently protect farmers and consumers?
Well, the law, the biosafety laws, looks pretty good on paper, but it's really about its implementation and also how it is enforced. So, for example, Malaysia has approved 14 GMOs to date for our food and feed and for processing. And some of these GMOs actually that we have approved in Malaysia have faced lots of restrictions and bans in other countries, in the EU in particular, in countries like Austria and also in other European countries like Norway. So we really have to ask the question whether our regulatory authorities are really adequately scrutinizing and doing the right thing when it comes to GMOs.
Another point of pushback in countries such as the United States has been the reported bullying of farmers when it comes to you know, organizations such as Monsanto, for example, that's been much reported. Do you find the same thing or do you foresee the same thing happening in our country where farmers are under pressure to use GMOs?
Well, as such, we don't have any GMOs that have actually been authorized for planting. So it's basically coming in as imports for our food and so on. So we could see that day when it starts to happen. But of course, our farmers are mainly planting rice and vegetables in this country. And of course, there's a lot of palm oil production going on. So it really remains to be seen, I guess. But it has happened in many countries.
Going back to that point about labelling, if foods contain less than 3% of GMOs, they need to be labelled. Is this sufficient?
No, it's not, because 3% is arbitrary. Some countries do have a higher threshold and some others have a zero threshold. And 3% was not a scientific threshold. It was an arbitrary policy threshold.
What's the risk assessment for GM foods like in Malaysia?
Well, what happens is that the applicant who wants a GMO approved in this country has to submit an application together with a risk assessment, a risk management, and an emergency response plan. And the risk assessment is actually conducted by industry. There is no requirement for an independent one to be done. So, of course, a company like Monsanto submitting an application would submit a risk assessment that's beneficial to its cause, right? The risk assessment would basically say, well, we looked at this and we scrutinized that and there
it's
are no
all
problems.
Fine.
And so it's safe and we, you know, we'd like you to approve it. And so it really, really depends on how closely this risk assessment is scrutinized, and really the Malaysian government should require an independent risk assessment, one that's not produced by the company itself, but one that is independently conducted and independently verified. And we should also look closely at who sits on these committees and what their vested interests may be, whether they are known to be pro-GM advocates and so on. I mean, these are really crucial question was when it comes to scrutinizing an application properly.
Risk assessment, when we use it in this context, is it to do with health? Is it to do with the environment? What does it cover?
It's supposed to cover both health and environment. And then, so that's considered the sort of scientific risk assessment. And then it goes up. So this is done at the level of what is known as the Genetically Modified Advisory Committee. So it's meant to be a scientific assessment. And then this goes up after that with a scientific recommendation to the Biosafety Board, which is more a policy body that is comprised of the various ministries. And they're also supposed to then take into account social and economic impacts and risks. So altogether, these make up the total assessment for GMOs in this country.
Do we yet know what effect GM crops have on the environment, you know, in any real concrete way?
Certainly. I mean, there have been many, many studies documenting the impacts on non-target organisms, increased weediness because of the use of herbicide-tolerant crops. There have been many cases where GMOs have contaminated non-GM crops, conventional as well as organic. And of course, these have led to other knock-on socioeconomic impacts, because if an organic farmer is contaminated by GMOs, then he will lose his organic certification, and that has quite severe consequences because organic food commands a premium in the market.
GM crops, however, have undeniably raised yields. So are we then denying cheaper foods and greater yields to the poor in developing countries by saying no to GMOs?
I'm afraid that assertion is also hotly contested that GM crops have raised yields. There are some studies that point to this, and it certainly may be true that initially this may be the case, but very soon the side effects of GM crops, which may be the increased weediness from the weeds around, the impacts on non-target organisms, begin to override the benefits of yield increase. So it's really a hotly contested issue, and there are many studies that also point to the contrary.
When we talk about the studies, you know, they can be a very difficult thing to understand. I think studies in general for the layperson can be very difficult because you often don't know the source, and more often than not, they contradict one another because you have industry studies, you have independent studies. So for a layperson who's trying to, you know, get their head around this whole concept of what they're actually eating, what they're actually purchasing, what should we be looking out for? And, you know, how do we kind of weigh out what one study is saying against another?
Yeah, unfortunately, it is complicated, and there's so much information and misinformation everywhere, especially on the internet. So it's really a difficult issue for the consumer because there are so many claims and counterclaims. But I think, like with any issue, you know, a critical, interested, thinking person needs to ask the relevant questions. You know, look at who funded the studies. Are there vested interests in a certain outcome? The scientists, this group, do they have ideological reasons for this and so on? So, I mean, it's really up to us as critical consumers to really study the facts properly. That's the only way we can really arrive at any conclusion that makes sense.
With so much being up in the air, and, you know, earlier you described that number of 3% as being a fairly arbitrary number. What's 3%? How many percent of what we eat in Malaysia is genetically modified?
Gosh, that's really hard to say because we don't have labelling, And of course, what I was describing with regards to the 14 GMOs that are already approved, that's actually GMOs that are coming in directly, and they would be like, you know, corn or soya bean. But there's also a lot of GM products coming in. So for example, if it's a packet of cornflakes is made with GM corn, that's not labeled in this country and is actually coming in without any regulation whatsoever. So it's important just to know basically what's available in the international market that's likely to be coming in, which is basically corn is highly engineered, so is soya, canola, which is for canola oil, and cotton, actually. These are the four major crops. So usually you could be not be so worried about the other crops, yeah, because these are the main major crops that have been engineered.
Of course, this isn't just about what we consume, but it's also coming in for feed. And 50% of Malaysian poultry is fed with GM, soya and corn. What are your concerns?
Well, there have been studies that have looked at the uptake of GM DNA in these animals that have been fed with GM feed, and there have been worrying results as well. So really, this needs to be further investigated, because we really are living in a situation where there's a lot of uncertainty and we don't actually know what the real impact of all this will be.
Is there any interest? Who is going to make those further investigations happen, though? Because it's, you know, we can make a lot of noise and say this needs to happen, but who are the people responsible for doing this, and how can we make them further these studies?
Yeah, well, there are many research groups that are independent around the world, and they may be based in universities and so on. I think this interest is certainly there. The main complaint really is that there's no funding available for independent research, because you know, when there's a lot of controversy about something and the industry applies a lot of pressure, governments respond, and so funding gets cut to many independent groups who would actually like to do the research and investigate this further.
Is GM food deemed halal by religious authorities in Malaysia?
Well, the last information that I heard about in this country was in 2011, where the Islamic, the Fatwa Council, actually said that as long as the gene that is introduced is from a halal source and the GMO basically does no harm, then it can be considered to be. So the converse, if it does some harm, then it's not, it's haram. And of course, that can be hotly debated whether or not it does harm. So I think that's still up for interpretation.
Looking at our government then, how much is the Malaysian government pushing for GM crops?
Well, there are different parts of government. So for example, the Biosafety Act sits under the national, the Biosafety Department, and that's under the Ministry of Natural Resources and Environment. On the other hand, you have the Malaysian Biotech Corporation and so on that come under the Ministry of Science, Technology and Investment. So you really have different arms of government that are looking after their own interests, and so it's a complicated landscape whereby you have arms of government that are more interested in health protection and environmental protection as opposed to others who are more interested in the industrial side of things.
With so little known about the absolute safety of GM foods, instead of saying all GM foods are unsafe because we don't know what will happen, you know, let's say 100 years from now, would it be fair to look at them instead on a case-by-case basis? Have some crops been deemed to be safe?
Yeah, so I think it's important to look at things on a case-by-case basis, because some GMOs certainly would carry some specific risk particular to that GMO that are not in others. But what's actually been the main concern is that the technology itself, the laboratory processes are very uncertain, and that is what is creating the problems with GMOs, because when you use a gene gun, for example, which is what is commonly used to blast into a particular gene into another organism, it's not certain where this will land in the genome. And it's because of this that unintended and unanticipated effects do occur.
Why are laboratory processes still uncertain when it has been a generation of use, you know, a generation of innovation?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not in industry, so I can't really answer this question, but maybe because perhaps, you know, there's been no need, there's been not enough pressure on the industry to actually improve their techniques and in their methods. So that could be one of the reasons.
A substantial number of scientists have said that when properly controlled, GM crops are benign. What's your response to that?
Well, it goes back again to what I was saying, which is that the technology in itself is inherently unstable. So if that is the case, and if that is what many independent scientists are contending, then the problem lies with all GMOs, not just some.
What would you say? I mean, so for me, the key phrase there is properly controlled. What would you consider proper control of GMOs, of the technology? Because, you know, I think, like it or not, it is perhaps unrealistic to expect us to roll back the last, you know, 20 or 30 years and say we'll obliterate this technology. It's here now. We can't get rid of it. So how then, what would proper control look like to you? What would be acceptable?
Well, many experiments can and should be done in properly contained conditions, in lab conditions, right? But it is irresponsible to release GMOs into the environment and to plant them and to let people eat them without having done adequate long-term independent studies.
With, of course, the counter-argument to that, again, would be that there's no time to do this. We need to push it out because some countries need that growth. They need food. You know, there's still famine around the world, and we need to address that as well. You know, how can we... Is there a way to do it simultaneously, quickly, and responsibly? Or do you think that those are just two opposing... You know, never the twain shall meet?
Well, I think that we need to be also responsible when we push out a technology, because often, as has been the case, we discover only too late that it actually has very adverse effects, and then it's too late to recall, right? The world is not starving because of a lack of food. And farmers have fed us over millennia using other conventional methods. This is really not the silver bullet that it's claimed to be. There could be some beneficial users, but really this technology has not been tested properly, and it should stay in the lab until it has been.
Stephen Tyndale, former executive director of Greenpeace UK, and Mark Lynas, a former environmental activist, are now pro-GM after looking deeply into the science. Is the anti-GM lobby missing something here? You know, is there a link that's missing in terms of communication?
Well, I mean, I don't know the exact personal circumstances of these two gentlemen. I've heard of Mark Lynas, and he is a very well-known and controversial pro-GM advocate, stirring up controversy wherever he goes and whatever he says and writes, basically. They make many contentions, but I think at the end of the day, again, it's really, we need to evaluate this critically, right? People will say things pro for and against, but we need to evaluate what they're actually saying. Does it stand up to scrutiny? We have to look at the facts. We have to look at their credibility. Are they being funded by industry? And what other motives may they have? Do they have vested interests and so on? That's really the only way that we can be thinking and critical about this issue.
Thank you very much. I've been speaking with Lim Lee Lin, senior researcher from Third World Network, and we've been discussing GMOs and GM foods here in Malaysia. You've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.